just don't know to what degree. Where would we be without THC? The higher side chat show. Greg Carwood and company. Yeah.
Serenity Now, Higher Side Chatters from the Sunshine State. I'm Greg Carwood. And one of the biggest frustrations a lot of us have with conventional geopolitical analysis is repeatedly seeing academics and historians that know all the right names and dates, yet they have a terrible grasp on true power and the mindset of those who have it and want to keep it. They remain ignorant of unadvertised motivations, secret pacts, and occulted belief systems that actually make the gears of the big machine move. They assume the goal of benevolent governance rather than complete subjugation and wealth extraction. They assume altruism when really they should be thinking unbridled global dominance. We're told to never attribute to malice what can be attributed to incompetence, but what is the functional difference between an incompetent elite class and an apathetic or even psychopathic one? How convenient that our first assumption should be that they mean well, even if the data shows us continuing to slide deeper into the red. When can we seek accountability based on the results rather than some hypothetical inference that they were at least trying to help? Well, one educator that seems to be bucking the trend in assumed elite ethics and going quite viral for it is today's guest, Professor Jiang of Predictive History. He started posting the lectures to his high school students in Beijing to YouTube in April of 2024 and has seen a meteoric rise in popularity, raking up millions of views because he's willing to explain how power really works throughout history. On his channel, you'll find lectures on damn near everything: meritocracy, Christian Zionism, geopolitics, Gnosticism, human psychology, how societies collapse, secret history, secret societies, the weaponization of culture, and most importantly, an objective and honest look at empire, game theory, and cycles in ways that help us better contextualize our own times. He also authors the number one rising Substack page in world politics, again under the name Predictive History. Inspired by Isaac Asimov's Foundation series and the concept of psychohistory, Professor Jiang seeks to start a new global intellectual academic movement that connects us to the past, explains the present, and even predicts what we can expect in the future through this predictive history lens. So let's dive into it. The global elite educator, psychohistory sense maker, and China's own Harry Sheldon, Professor Jiang, welcome to the Higher Side.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Yes, it is a real pleasure and honor. I'm a big fan of what you do and how you do it. I'm a real sucker for a nice whiteboard presentation, but elaborate on the goal and approach that you take. Obviously, history lectures are nothing new, but why do you think yours have resonated so much?
So thank you so much for inviting me, Greg. I'm a big fan of yours. I've been watching your interviews for the past couple of days. But before I answer your question, I want to tell a story of how we got to this point, because I think your viewers will find it really interesting. So I was watching Kirk Metzger, his live stream, and you were on the live stream, I believe a couple of weeks ago. You guys were having this great conversation and you were making some great points. And I was feeling myself how I would love to sit down with you guys and engage in a conversation. And then suddenly a person gives you a super chat and on the screen, my name comes up and says, "Hey, have you guys seen Predictive History? What do you think of Professor Jiang?" You know, I'm like, wow, that's interesting. And then the next day you email me and says, "Hey, I would love to interview you." And then I write back immediately and says, "Hey, I would love to talk to you as well." So it seems as though the universe wants us to be here today. It seems as though the universe wants this moment to happen. So I'm really excited to talk to you today. I've been watching your videos for the past couple of days. I love your interviews. I love the questions you ask. I love your approach. I just love the way that you see the universe. So I just want to get it out there before we begin.
Wow, super kind of you. And yes, I agree that I like synchronicities that happen like that. And here we are.
Yeah, so to answer your question, so I'm trying to start a movement that reexamines how study is analyzed and presented. My concern with history before is that it tells a great story. It's very entertaining, but it seems incoherent. There are different pieces. And they all seem off in their own little silos. And so we don't really see history as a coherent narrative about how we got to where we are and where we're going. So my thinking is that each time you tell a story, you are making certain assumptions about the values, about mores of people. And so what you can do is you can take these assumptions and extend it forward. You can extrapolate them into the future. And so your analytical model becomes your predictive model. And so what this means is that just by making predictions about the future based on your understanding of history, you can test if your understanding of history is correct or not. So I believe that historians ought to be making more predictions about the world in order to test their own models, in order to validate and refine their own analytical models. And so what I've done is that in the past 2 years, I've told the story of civilization, of humanity, from the Ice Age up to the very present, the Pax Americana. And so embedded in this analysis are these frameworks of how history moves, of how history develops. And so based on that, I can now make certain assumptions or predictions about where we're going in the next 50 years. And so these predictions will then allow me to validate my analytical models. So that's the basic premise of what I'm trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think it's going really well. If you look at your most popular videos, the number one up there, 1.5 million views, is you talking about the Iran trap. And a year ago, you kind of broke down the geopolitical strategy between the U.S., Israel, and Iran, basically laying out well in advance a lot of what has happened in the last year and the motivations behind the actions and where it will go now. Let's start there. Talk to us a little bit about the decline of the West, which is a huge theme in your work, and the geopolitical actions you expect to be taken as this process kind of runs its course.
If you just look at the grand trajectory of history, empires rise and fall. There's nothing you can do about it. So I believe that America right now is in the decline phase. And when it's in the decline phase, it behaves in a certain way that's erratic, that's violent, and which is counterproductive. And we're very much seeing this sort of behavior today, where America is heavily in debt. Economic inequality is off the charts. The bureaucracy, the political elite, it's ossified, it is insular, and it's stagnant, and it's very corrupt. And America right now is, the empire is overextended. It has over 800 military bases around the world. It's fighting all these wars, both shadow wars and overt wars everywhere. And as a result, we can see that in the next 10, 20 years, there will be a decline in American power, but this decline will be erratic, be violent, and it'll be very destructive. So that's what I see happening right now.
Yes, and you have one lecture where you put up three columns and you talk about kind of the stages of a civilization. You talk about how in the beginning or in the rise, in the good times, a civilization is very open. And then as things are progressing and going well, it gets increasingly bureaucratic because there's more people involved in all the processes and they get very bogged down. And then it goes to a stage of authoritarian. And to me, that resonates a lot because for the longest time, we've talked about how nothing gets done in this country because they kind of hide behind the gridlock, the left-right divide. They're like, well, I mean, we just can't get the votes. We can't do anything. Sorry, people. We can't do anything to raise your wages or help you or give you any relief because we just don't have the votes. It's the other team. And it goes back and forth. And yes, incredibly bureaucratic. And then people get so frustrated. They say, you know what? Just bring in a guy to break everything. Like, just bring in a guy to get some shit done. And yeah, it's a double-edged sword because our country's not founded on authoritarianism necessarily, or the idea of one person. We try to get away from kingship, it seems like that's the American story. But yet we get to a point where we're so frustrated with no progress and the bureaucracy that we are almost asking in a problem, reaction, solution sort of way for someone to cut through all the checks and balances and just get something done for us. So I think that model, and there are other elements of it, but yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with how it's kind of gamed to get us to ask for an authoritarian figure.
That's right. So, you know, a classic analogy is of course, the fall of the Roman Republic. When you have, you know, a few patrician families, they've monopolized all the resources. And the way that they create wealth is by forcing everyone else to go into heavy debt. So one huge issue during the fall of the Roman Republic was the monopolization of land. The patrician class, the aristocratic class, they control and monopolized all the land. and everyone else was heavily in debt. And we're seeing the same issue in America today, where you have, you know, a few corporations, BlackRock, Vanguard, and they've monopolized all the resources, even the land itself. So, you know, the average American has become a rentier. Now it's become the rentier economy. So it's a very similar pattern in history. And as you know, during the fall of the Roman Republic, you had a series of crises, and certain individuals that were extremely charismatic, they came into power promising to change the system. You first had the Gracchi brothers, then you had Sulla, then you had Julius Caesar, and then you finally had Augustus Caesar. So it seems as though America will follow this pattern, and Trump is one of the first great demagogues that's sort of being propelled into power because of the discontent of the people. And he promises very much to smash the system.
Well, that's great to hear that Trump's just the first of a couple demagogues we might get before it all falls apart.
Yeah.
So one of your most popular lectures, to get more specific, you lay out 5 predictions for the West in the next 5 to 10 years. Maybe it takes 20. You know, it's more about the trend, not the exact speed in which we run through these things. But the 5 are decline of democracy and freedom, more authoritarian approaches to things, check. Economic collapse, as people have less rights to speak up in the system, they also have less will to work and the system collapses. They're less vested in that. I think we see that with the younger generations in particular. And then immigration. So they say, let's bring in the immigrants to do the work that the people don't want to do. And then that results in conflicts and civil war, as you say. And then the elite will say, well, now that the people are fighting, before they think this through and come for us, the real problem, let's send them to die in stupid foreign wars. And you say that we will see all 5 of these things happen, maybe in a slightly different order, but they do kind of cascade. At this point in the life cycle, you either get war or revolution, you say, and to avoid revolution, the elite will opt for war. So what are some recent events that you might cite as evidence that these predictions are well on their way to coming true, especially the foreign wars aspect?
Well, I mean, first of all, in American domestic politics, you have tremendous political polarization. And this polarization creates gridlock. So, you know, today in America, they've shut down the government. That's one sign. Another sign is that for the past few months, Trump has deployed ICE agents into American cities. But the thing is that the rate of deportation under Trump, it's still lower than that under Obama. So then you ask yourself, so many agents are being deployed, but not that many immigrants are being deported. Well, why is this happening? And the answer, of course, is that Trump is trying to create a police state. You also have the deployment of National Guard units to major cities in America. You have massive clampdown on social media, right? So recently, TikTok has been bought by Larry Ellison. We can expect major changes to the algorithm. And so people's ability to express themselves will be severely limited. And of course, yesterday, Peter Hegseth and Donald Trump spoke to 800 generals. And it seems as though it was a pep rally. Now, what was disturbing about the pep rally is that Peter Hegseth kept on emphasizing the enemy, the enemy, the enemy. But he was not being specific about who the enemy is. There was no objectives being articulated. There was no timeline. So it seemed as though America is about to go to war with everyone, right? Yeah. I mean, like if you just said that China is our number one enemy and we must prepare ourselves for the 21st century confrontation with China, and that's a defining strategic objective of America, that makes sense. Or if you said Russia, or if he said, okay, our focus is on the homeland. But he was being very, very ambiguous about who the enemy is. And so it seems like a very open-ended process. So that to me is very, very worrying. And of course, Donald Trump has been saying for a long time now that these democratic cities, these sanctuary cities, Chicago and Boston and New York City, they're actually a threat to the republic because they refuse the authority of the president. And so we can expect greater clashes between these urban cities and Washington, D.C. moving forward. As you know, Russia and Iran have both come out and said that they expect Israel to strike Iran again next week or 2 weeks. And we can expect that when Israel does this, it will do so with the full support of Trump and the Pentagon. And we can expect that Iran will respond much more violently than in the first war, the 12-day war. And this will lead to a cascading effect where eventually you might see a sustained war where America deploys ground troops. You could also see possibly Iran closing off the Strait of Hormuz, which would drag in other countries as well. And this could be the beginning of World War III. You look at what's happening in Europe. You know, so recently there were the Moldova elections where a pro-European party retained power. And we can expect more conflict between Moldova and Russia. France, Britain, and Germany have already come out and said that they want their hospitals to be ready for mass casualty events starting next year. You have these drone incursions into Poland, into your NATO nations. So, I mean, all the signs are we're moving towards major global conflicts as well as domestic repression in America.
Yes, that's a great summary. And I've heard you say when it comes to Russia, Ukraine, there's estimates of over 1 million dead already, and the average age of their soldiers is now 40 or over 40, which is like really not sustainable. It basically shows they're out of people to throw at this thing. And you say that from there, you expect NATO countries like France to say, okay, we're sending people in. And now it's on, you know, at that point, you know, you got European nations fighting directly with Russia, and it's not this isolated thing just to Ukraine. So that's one problem. But then I've also heard you talk about the Middle East and the game theory of it all, and that Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, you know, three countries that are definitely not aligned, they're in opposition to each other, but yet they all would benefit from America getting bogged down in the Middle East, and in particular, ground troops in Iran, which sounds so far-fetched because there's a perception narrative here that Trump actually doesn't want war, but there's a lot of people in the cabinet and in the deep state that are like foaming at the mouth, just dying to get into a war. And that would be why he did something like that strike on Iran, that precision strike on the nuclear facilities. It was kind of to say, look, you've been hyping up this problem. I'm going to do a precision strike to take care of that problem and keep the conflict kind of tampered down, and then we can say it's done. And so there is a perception that Trump himself doesn't really like war. He'd prefer to just do business, different kinds of business, and war kind of gets in the way of that business. I don't know how true that is, but it seems like the American machine is more than just one man, regardless of how he might feel. But talk to us about that aspect, that Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Iran all kind of want the same thing when it comes to America. It benefits them all, even though you wouldn't necessarily think that on the surface.
Okay, so what's happening in the Middle East, it's very complicated, and it's very easy to reduce it into just an issue of pure economics. America right now is heavily in debt. It's $37 trillion in debt. And so it needs other countries, especially East Asia, China, Japan, specifically, to continue to buy up U.S. treasuries. So right now, the American economy is one giant Ponzi scheme. It needs people to continue to buy up U.S. treasuries in order for this Ponzi scheme to continue. So it makes sense for America to take control over the entire global oil supply, right? So if you go in and you control Iran, then you control the entire Middle East oil supply. But then you also go into Venezuela, which has been proven to have the world's largest oil reserves, right? So you control Venezuela, you control Iran, Saudi Arabia is already an ally. Well, then you can now dictate oil prices to Japan and to South Korea and to China because their entire economy is dependent on Middle Eastern oil. You can also dictate oil prices to Europe as well. So purely from the economic perspective, going into Iran makes sense. But I think that actually a much deeper element, and it's eschatological. And what I mean by that is that there are certain religious elements that control the American national security apparatus. These are the Christian Zionists, the evangelicals. You also have the Freemasons. You also have the Mormons. You also have the Jesuits. You also have these religious extremist Jews. They all want a war to erupt in the Middle East because for them, it's fulfillment of biblical prophecy. They have these grand plans for the future. It's messianic. And they think that by initiating a war in the Middle East and dragging the entire world to start World War III, you will create something called the War of Gog and Magog. And when the War of Gog and Magog emerges, then the Jewish Messiah will return. Jesus will return. You have a world government. So different, you know, religious traditions have different eschatologies, but they all want this war in the Middle East in order to fulfill their prophecy. It's almost like a script to them. And I believe that these different religious elements have been working together, controlling the national security apparatus. And that's how we got to the point where we are today. And people will argue, listen, I think you can legitimately argue that this goes way back to the founding of America, that America was founded in order to achieve this biblical prophecy. And it links up with the JFK assassination. It links up with 9/11. And this is the culmination of a plan that was hatched centuries ago. And as a result, they're kind of desperate. They're kind of in a rush. They're anxious to actually achieve this plan on a very short timeline, like within the next 5 to 10 years. Like it's like they've been running a marathon for 100 days, and now they finally see the finish line. And the finish line might be up like a steep mountain, but they still want to get there, even though it kills them. So yeah, so I think you can see what's happening in the Middle East from a purely economic, realistic perspective. But I think that if you really want to understand what's going on, then you need to go deeper and examine the religious, eschatological elements. So one way to test our theory is look at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. I believe in the next 6 months to a year, that thing will be destroyed. And I'm sure you and your listeners understand what this means for the world. I mean, the entire Islamic world will be up in arms if they destroy the third holiest site in Islam. And if you just look at it from a purely geopolitical perspective, you don't understand why they would do that. But you have to understand that for all these different religious elements, destroying that Al-Aqsa Mosque and building that third temple, it is fundamental to achieving the biblical prophecy that they have in mind.
Yes, and I think it's so interesting to watch your lectures where you get into Gnosticism and the Nephilim, and the Book of Enoch is on your recommended reading list for your students. I mean, I just think it's so odd to see that, to see a Chinese high school teacher teaching kids about the Book of Enoch because it relates to how power in the West operates. And sometimes I think it's quite silly that it all comes down to like this book and no one's really sure how much stock to even put in the book. And like this, it is weird that it drives everything. I am curious about the East. I mean, the East obviously has its own religions. I'm thinking more like, you know, Buddhism and that kind of thing, as opposed to like Islam, you know, that because that's another Abrahamic religion. But is there anything like that when it comes to the history of power in China or the East, in the notion of trying to manifest some old prophecy from some old religious residue of the last couple hundred years? Is that uniquely Western? I mean, I can't even say Western because, again, we're talking about Israel and we're talking about Iran. They're part components of this. But in terms of China's history, is there any kind of similar parallel situation?
So China is in a unique situation. Because for thousands of years, China was isolated from the rest of the world. So if you go back and look at world history, you know, Iran, the Persian Empire, Israel, Egypt, Europe, they were always in conflict with each other. They were always in a dialectic with each other. And that's why Western civilization, it is so diverse. It is so eschatological. But if you look at China has these natural boundaries that protect it from too much Western influence, right? So to the east, you have the sea. To the west, you have the Himalayas. To the south, you have the jungles of Southeast Asia. To the north, you have the desert. So China was able to maintain its distance and its territorial integrity. And because of this, it was able to develop a bureaucracy that was in charge for thousands of years. Now, bureaucracies don't like religion. Bureaucracies see religion as a threat because religion has a way of exciting people in unexpected and unpredictable ways.
Yes.
And so all these different religious traditions that existed in China were slowly diluted, or you can even use the word lobotomized. And so they lost their almost divinity. They lost their connections to the divine. And an example of this is how in China, we actually don't have that much mythology. We don't have that many stories that we tell each other. So, you know, in the West, every holiday has, you know, layers and layers of rich mythology. Whereas in China, our holidays, like Chinese New Year's, Mid-Autumn Festival, it's all about food. It's all about people getting together and having food. It doesn't really go into the past and discuss how we reached this point. And the reason why is that stories allow people to have an imagination. And that's a threat to the bureaucratic worldview. And as a result, for thousands of years, there's heavy censorship in China. So all these Chinese classics that we still read today, they're very much diluted versions of the original. It sort of lacks imagination. It lacks originality. It seems very much like a bureaucratic took these stories and lobotomized these stories of their creativity and their originality. So that's the issue in China today.
Yes, I really only know one Chinese myth, and it's the Journey to the West story, the monkey god, because there's a video game based on it. That's how I consume these things. But let's talk about China a little bit more, because you recently tweeted, in America, you can criticize individuals, but you cannot criticize the system. In China, you can criticize the system, but you cannot criticize individuals. And I'm curious how true that is and where the truth is compared to the propaganda that we get inside of the American bubble. We hear that China's a very restrictive society, not a lot of place for criticism of the CCP, lots of human rights abuses, organ harvesting of the poor, and a technocratic social credit control system implemented nationwide, or at least in the major cities, that our technocrats are trying to duplicate. So a lot of times when American independent journalists are trying to say what we should watch out for, they're usually saying, we want to watch out for what's already in place in China, the facial recognition on the street, the sending you a fine if you've jaywalked. You know, there's the complete control. How true is that of Chinese society? Like, and how much of it is hype and propaganda?
Yeah, so I think that in terms of organization, Westerners are much more effective than Chinese. You know, Chinese, it's very much about personality politics. It's about who you know. It's almost like a mafia state. You have these different mafia organizations at war with each other. And that's what occupies most of their political energy in China. So there really isn't that much organization. There isn't really that much interest in trying to create this authoritarian facade. It really much is a facade. So they have this sort of stuff, but it doesn't work as effectively as you think it works as. I've been trying for the past 30 years, and I'll be very honest with you. I've been able to think and write and teach as I deem fit. And a lot of it is because I choose not to get rich in China. So in China, if you want to get rich, you have to submit your will to the party. You have to find a powerful political patron. That person will sponsor you, but then, of course, you have to become obedient to that person. And that's how the system works. If you want to become rich, you have to play ball. But if you don't become rich, like me, if you're like, I don't really care, I just want to have intellectual freedom, then China can be one of the freest places on earth. And that sounds very strange and paradoxical, but it is true. And you can tell from my essays on Substack, you can tell from my lectures in the classroom. As long as I choose not to get rich, as long as I choose not to monetize my fame, people will leave me alone in China. But if I became a millionaire, then people are going to come knock on my door and says, hey, where's my cut? And that's a situation in China.
Very interesting. Yes, some things you say there sound a lot like America. It is a mafioso system to a degree. And to get rich here, you know, yeah, capitalism allows you to make some choices and do your own thing. But also, if you want to get really rich, I mean, you have to play the game and be a part of the system the way they want you to. So, yeah, I mean, it isn't really that different. So for people who don't really know your background, you were born in China in 1976. Your family immigrated to Canada in 1983 when you were just 7 years old. Your family was poor, but you were hungry and desperate enough that Yale did accept you. You graduated, you went back to China and have taught at all age levels and have been pretty active trying to push for education reforms in China. I'm curious what reforms you think are needed. How would you explain the differences in the Chinese education system compared to the West? Because I assume both have their own distinct processes of breaking people down.
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest with you. I think the differences are not as stark as I once believed them to be. Given what's happened in the Western world, given what's happened in China, I think that these two cultures are sort of converging. So for the longest time in China, my biggest concern was the concept of individuality. I wanted my students to learn in a way that would inspire them to reach and fulfill their true potential as individuals. And that required a concept of your own individual agency, basically to believe that you have your own soul and the soul is eternal, and it would bring you delight and happiness to make the soul shine in the world. Okay, so that was the concept that I was trying to promote in China. And I was trying to do this through many mechanisms. So I started China's first public school international program that was modeled of a American liberal arts college. You know, we had a 5,000 book English library. We had seminar classes. We had a daily newspaper. And then the idea was to provide a space for students to develop a passion for learning and a sense of their own individual agency that would carry them for the rest of their lives. And that didn't really work out because, as you can imagine, parents didn't like that concept. Parents wanted to micromanage their children. And so I really didn't succeed in that field. And for the past 4 years, I've been working just as a high school teacher, just teaching the great books. And that's been very successful. So if you work students at an individual level and you introduce Plato, Homer, Dante, Shakespeare to them at an individual level, then it's almost as though they find the spark in them. It's almost as though the entire purpose of the great books, Homer and Dante specifically, is to remind people that there's a divine spark in them. And this divine spark will always connect to the higher good.
Mm. I love that. You kind of Trojan horsed it in. You kind of found a way to package it in an acceptable manner. And that's a beautiful thing. I think that the self-actualization that is kind of popular in the West is probably one of the best features of it. And our perception of China is that it's very centralized and very much like find your place as a cog in this machine. It's thought of as like an anthill. You know, everyone has no individualization. They are just working for the system. And from our perspective, that's like terrifying. That's like really a terrible way to live because you have no individualized meaning. Of course, our system is trying to stomp it out and makes it like a really strong current of a river that you have to swim upstream to find that self-actualization and any kind of economic equivalent to it. But yeah, I think that's super interesting. So I like that in several lectures, you make it clear that you're not teaching morals or ethics. You're not teaching what should be done. You're teaching about the world as it is, and you're teaching about power and how it really thinks and what it really does. You also have said power is really about narrative and that the crafters of the West really did alchemy, turning nothing into everything. I love that. Very provocative terminology. I don't know how far to take it really, but elaborate on some of these things for us. Power, narrative, and alchemy.
Right. Yeah. So if you just look at the source of American power today, it's really the idea of the US dollar as the global reserve currency. And if you just ask yourself, what is the US dollar based on? It's just based on faith in America. It's just based on trust that the American government will not fall and collapse and not go into debt and default. Okay, that's all it is. Now, 1945, you have the Bretton Woods Conference. And at that point, the US dollar was in fact pegged to gold. And so before 1971, before Nixon declared that the US dollar would no longer be pegged to gold, you could at any point convert US dollar, your US dollars into real gold. And that's what the French did right before 1971. But after 1971, They got rid of that system. So now it's alchemy. It's just pure faith in the American government. Now, it's a bit complicated because Nixon did two things that was very important to maintain the value and the authority and the credibility of the U.S. dollar. Okay, so the first thing it did, of course, was to work with Saudi Arabia to create the petrodollar. So Saudi Arabia would only take U.S. dollars in payment for its oil. And at that time, Saudi Arabia was the world's largest oil producer. So the petrodollar was born at that time. The other thing that he did that was even more important, which people don't really understand, is he opened China up to the global system. 1972, he visits China. In the 80s, China slowly becomes embedded into the global financial system, right? And at this time, and people don't really appreciate this, America is giving China free technology, free expertise, and free market access, right? So basically, America purposefully, intentionally built up the Chinese export economy to make China dependent on U.S. dollars. And this relationship still continues today. China exported its cheap labor in the way that Saudi Arabia exported its cheap oil to America. In exchange, they all got U.S. dollars. And these two things is what underpins the value of the U.S. dollar today. Unfortunately, what's happened is that America has abused its exorbitant privilege, and now it is $37 trillion in debt. America's never going to pay off this debt. So I'm going to be forced to default on this debt, which is very likely, or get China, Japan to continue to buy up U.S. treasuries. And obviously, if you're China, you're reluctant to do so because it's a giant Ponzi scheme, and eventually you're going to be caught holding the bag. So that's an example of how perception drives reality. How the world we live in, it's just pure alchemy, right? People believe that money has value. Another thing that people don't appreciate is how money is created. So, you know, Richard Werner, he talks a lot about this in his book, The Prince of Yen, okay? So how does a modern banking system work? Well, most people believe that if I go and take out a loan, $5 million, well, it comes from deposits money, right? Because some people put in $5 million of deposits money, and then you take it out and you go invest it, open a restaurant or whatever. But what people don't really appreciate is the idea of double entry bookkeeping, which goes way back. And the idea of double entry bookkeeping is that a bank, when it loans you $5 million, it creates $5 million out of thin air. It's not taking deposits money and giving it to you, it's creating it out of thin air. When it loans you that money, it's actually increasing its assets. So if you just look at Chinese banks have become some of the most largest banks in the world. Why? Because it kept on letting money and money out of the system. And in the double entry booking system, debt is considered assets. And so that's something that normal people don't appreciate. And I think that, you know, if you just explain this to someone on the streets, that person couldn't possibly conceive what you're talking about. And that just shows you how powerful these narratives have become embedded into the social fabric of today.
Yeah, those are really great points. I remember when I was first kind of red-pilled on the fractional reserve banking system, and it did take a while. I was like, there's just no way that's how it works. There's no way it's that simple, and there's no way it's that fragile, and yet it seems to be the reality. So I heard you talk in one of your recent videos about how when you look at the feedback you get, obviously a lot of it's positive, but they say some of your weak areas are economics and philosophy. So I hesitate to even bring this up, but in terms of the debt that the U.S. has, I only am bringing it up really because even Putin's finance minister brought it up, but there is something called the stablecoin gamut that it seems like America is going to try. And obviously, I don't want our system to collapse, so I hope it's a little successful. But instead of all the oil stuff, it seems as if the plan is to move to stable coins and to open up banking to like much smaller tech companies. The tech companies can now be the new banks. And as long as they hold U.S. dollars, again, you got to create the artificial demand to supplement the huge supply of the printing of the money. So instead of Saudi Arabia taking dollars for oil, it's going to be stable coins now. And the goal is to open up banking to the second and third world to individual people because they're going to have an interest yield on the stable coins. So you'll be able to, as an individual, there's a lot of places in the world where if you can get 5% on your money and you can just have even a couple $1,000s, like some people live on a few dollars a day. So this kind of seems like a win-win in a lot of ways. It, of course, usurps governments around the world if they get the other government citizens to start participating in such a thing. But it seems like this is the plan, that if they can get all these fintech banks to pop up and then say, you're allowed to issue stablecoin, but you must keep reserves in US dollars. There's some calculations that say in a few years, we might be able to get close to $30 trillion parked around the world in tech companies that way. I'm curious your thoughts on that plan. Another reason I think it's a good plan, I mean, obviously, the people who made the problem are not the people whose lap it is in right now. So you have to have a little bit of empathy for this Hail Mary. But I just think there's a couple of positive aspects to it. And one of them is that it might avoid the war that we seem to be going towards based on the need for it. It might be like this third rail issue. So what do you think about the stable coin gamut that America might be trying to toss out there?
Right. So as you mentioned, economics is definitely not my strong suit. So I'll probably be screamed at by economists. Okay. But I have two feelings. Okay. So the first is that let's use a thought experiment. Let's just say 10 years ago, we're in Canada or France or Germany, and we see certain crises on the horizon. Okay. So first is the aging crisis. Our population is getting older and older. We have too much debt. The young people are not as energetic as they used to be. Okay. So, you know, we get together different central bankers or in the Western world, and we discuss how to resolve this issue. And we come up with this great plan. Okay. We call this plan open borders, right? Because what we're going to do is this: we're going to import all these immigrants from India, from China, from the Philippines, from South America, who cares, okay? But they're young, they're 20s. Great plan, because these guys are energetic, right? And they're gonna open restaurants, and they're gonna be construction workers, and they're gonna be honest, and they're not gonna take advantage of our welfare system, and they're not gonna cause any crime. And as a result, it's a net positive for our society, and it resolves all the issues that we've accumulated. And so, guess what? They actually did this, okay? In Britain, in France, in Canada, in Australia, and it's a complete dumpster fire.
Yes.
All right. So I don't know if the stablecoin work out or not, but I imagine if it comes from a bureaucrat who has very little imagination and who is trying to solve a big problem with a very easy solution, I imagine that it'll probably be a dumpster fire. And you're not giving enough agency to individuals, right? Like if you are the game maker and you create this crappy game which everyone loses, guess what, guys? Everyone's gonna cheat in this game, right? So these immigrants who go to Canada and they're expected to work like for minimum wage for 50 years so this old pensioner can collect his pension. Well, it's a crappy game for him. So why would he be an honest broker in this game? Why would he be honest? And why would he be hardworking when the game is completely rigged against him? He's gonna cheat. He's going to be like, you know what? I'm going to give him a system in a way that allows me to win, right? So the stablecoin system, it looks great. But if you just look at it from a different perspective, it screws over the people who buy into the stablecoin, right? So do you think that that when they buy in and knowing that they'll be cheated, they're going to play honestly? I don't think they will. I don't think you give these people enough credit. I think they're extremely imaginative. I think they're very spontaneous. And they work together very well. And I imagine that if they do this, I'm not sure if they will do this, but look, these are bureaucrats who have no imagination. It's going to blow up in their face. This is a pattern that repeats itself throughout history, okay? So that's point one. Point two is, we have to remember why America is able to get away with being the world's reserve currency in the world. And the answer is, it's the sole hegemon in the world. If you don't play ball, America can come and bomb the crap out of you like it did in Libya, in Syria, which did not have central banks, by the way, okay? So America can do that. And it sets these examples and everyone just plays along. But if there's another hegemon that's emerging, like Russia or China, you wanna hedge your bets now. You're like, you know what? I wanna invest in America, but I also wanna invest in Russia, and in China. I want to have a portfolio. And I don't think these American policymakers are aware that we're moving towards a multipolar world. And a lot of their assumptions, a lot of their calculations are based on a unipolar world. And that's why I don't think there's a viable solution to the crises that America is facing right now.
No, those are fair critiques. And anyone who's been involved in crypto thus far knows that several exchanges have already folded because they were being dishonest about their reserves. And basically, there was a digital bank run. You know, it's really not any different as, well, we put a lot of stuff out there on paper and people came to collect and we don't have it. So we're just going to shut the doors and sorry, guys. I mentioned you went to Yale, and I think that's really interesting for a lot of people probably around here are a little skeptical of that. They probably see that as a red flag, as you know, because of the way the system, the Ivy League system is set up. And that's a really interesting part of your work. So talk to people about your insights into particularly Harvard and the Ivy League of American schools, because some of these thoughts are that it just seems like Harvard's been very crucial in particular and has been kind of curating and essentially engineering the true influencers of the American controller class, basically churning out psychopaths, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, look, if Donald Trump got into a fight with Harvard and Yale and the Ivy League, and if Donald Trump were to bankrupt these institutions and these institutions were to disappear from the face of the earth, I guarantee you that America will enter the golden age. It will make America great again.
Interesting.
Because I think these Ivy League institutions have been parasites on the American Republic. They pay no taxes on their endowment. They were land-grant universities. They get billions of dollars in federal contracts. So they're parasitic. And then you ask yourself, what have they contributed to America? Well, let's go over the list, okay? First thing they created is this Hunger Games education system that's in America today. I mean, it's traumatizing young children. When I went to Yale, it was the Hunger Games. Like, you know, I thought that when I got to Yale, it's like paradise. I go there, it's a country club, and then I graduate and I become a lawyer, and then my life is good. But it's really the Hunger Games. You go there, and from day one, they expect you to compete against your classmates because, you know, Yale graduates 1,500 students a year, but they only need about like 10 to succeed, because if these 10 succeed, they succeed spectacularly. And so it's almost like a venture capital firm in that, you know, you invest 1,000 companies knowing that 900 of them will fail. But hey, you need one or two to be unicorns and you're good. And you don't really care what happens to the people in these 900 companies that fail. So we're almost like disposable tools that Yale is using in order to burnish its reputation. So the first thing that I would say about the Ivy League is that it's really the Hunger Games that's traumatizing young people in America today. Second thing is that it's led to tremendous inequality in America. If you just look at all the wealthy people, they tend to graduate from these Ivy League institutions, which are private, and then they give their money to these Ivy League institutions. And these Ivy League institutions are not interested in helping America. They're only interested in improving their endowment. And so they let in all these princelings from China. They let in all these children of tyrants from Africa. I mean, like these Ivy League schools, they're multinationals. They behave like multinationals. That's not interested in giving back to America and helping America develop. It's only interested in helping themselves. Another thing that I will say Ivy League is that it's led to tremendous mediocrity among the American elite. You look at people like Barack Obama and J.D. Vance and George W. Bush. They were all credential members of the Ivy League. They all went to the schools, and then they came out, and then they were sort of ushered into positions of power. They have no imagination. They have no critical thinking skills. They have no empathy, and they have no capacity to reflect. Listen, I know this is going to sound like an extreme statement, but I think the Ivy League is the ultimate MK Ultra experiment.
Mm.
Wow. That's what I think. I think that if you went to Ivy League and you did well in the system, now you are an MK Ultra Manchurian candidate, because all you care about, okay, you are so desperate for approval, okay, you're so desperate for success and achievement, because you're a hollow shell, that you will do anything in order to succeed, right? I mean, I've said this in my lectures, but I think people who graduate from the Ivy League and who ascend to the top, they're soulless. They have no ideas of their own. They're only interested in success for the sake of success. I think, you know, you go back to America in the early decades. You know, George Washington never went to college. Abraham Lincoln, you know, went to night school. And they were great. And that's what I think, you know, what was great about America, because it was a society focused on individual achievement. It was a society focused on talent. And nowadays, the Ivy League represents a rigged game in which the winners will always win and everyone else is a loser. I mean, you with the Ivy League, the advent of the Ivy League, with the now that the Ivy League has monopolized education, you have the complete collapse of the American dream. You have the complete collapse of social mobility. Mm-hmm. So I honestly don't have anything nice to say about these institutions.
Yeah, I find that to be really interesting. It's just not an aspect of American culture that really is targeted and highlighted as often as it probably should be. And you cover a lot of that history in a video titled Death by Meritocracy. And I was going to bring up the points you're making right now, that it really isn't a critique on a true meritocracy. You're criticizing a corrupt, rigged, closed loop of controller class wealthy families that lord over the rest of us. That is not a merit-based system. That is a private club and a privileged-based system. And it's a lot like how when people talk about the free market here, like, let the free market do its thing. It's like, well, come on, the free market is pretty rigged. So if you really want a free market, I will take that bet. But that means a lot of the legacy privilege and legacy systems and massive multinational corporations would go away, or at least wouldn't have the same favor that they have. So I see like a parallel there. But when people are talking about Trump trying to institute a meritocracy, it's like, well, of course, nothing in its pure form is implemented. It's always got all these caveats to it. But if not a meritocracy, then what? I mean, I think I support the notion of a meritocracy, but what you're criticizing in this video with that title doesn't really qualify.
That's right. Yeah, so I think that in the past few years, America has become a credentialized society. And before, it wasn't. Before, you know, you go back 100 years, people didn't want to go to university because they didn't want to be like an egghead. There was a deep-rooted skepticism of intellectuals in America. And that system worked really well. I mean, I don't understand why jobs require a college degree. Certain jobs require a college degree, right? If you are a professor, of course you need a college degree. You have a PhD, but most jobs don't require a college degree. What you do, what I do, don't require a college degree. If I want to become a teacher, I shouldn't have to go to college. I should have to go to a teacher's college, which is what happened, you know, 50, 100 years ago. So I think that in this past 50 years, there's been this massive expansion of the tertiary education system, of higher education, of universities. And a lot of these universities have absolutely no business being universities. They should be trade schools, or they should be professional schools, but they shouldn't be universities, right? And what's happened is that a lot of these universities have become glorified party schools. You know, kids go there to drink beer and watch football games for 4 years. And you can tell, because when you go to these universities, what they really brag about is not, you know, the quality of the professors. What they really bragged about is the quality of their dorm rooms, right?
And the sports teams.
I mean, like, yeah. So I think the higher education system everywhere, okay, not just in America, but also in China, it's bloated, it's unnecessary. And I think that if we would go back to a system more focused on vocational training, trade schools, community colleges, that would that'd be better for everyone in the long term.
Yes, great points. And another thing that's changed in America is you used to get a job and then your first month or two is training. Now you get a job and they're like, you're supposed to already know how to do the job. We're not training you. You're working from day one. And that system creates a lot of inefficiencies too. And people may not realize go ahead.
Sorry, I want to make this point, okay? So I'm in China and the medical system is staffed by the worst students in China, because no one wants to be a doctor in China. Everyone wants to be a financier or a scientist or a politician, but no one wants to be a doctor. So the worst kids are, you know, siphoned into the medical system. And what happens is they have 2 to 4 years of mentorship, and then, you know, they do 5 to 10 years of an internship, and they're fine. Because being a good doctor, it's not about how smart you smart you are. It's about how much experience you have, how much mentorship you have, how much guidance you have. And so China has a pretty good medical system, even though the students who become doctors were not the best students in the school. And you compare that with the American system. So you have a medical system which is bloated, expensive, and deeply parasitical, unfair, unjust. And it's staffed by, you know, the smartest students in America. So you know, the large point I'm trying to make is that most jobs, I would say every job, does not require you to go through a meritocracy. It requires you to be mentored and apprenticed in a proper way. If you just did that, then everyone would have access to the American dream.
Yeah, great points. That's another thing that we don't have as much as we used to, is the mentor-mentee relationship. And just bringing up the Chinese medical system is interesting because, of course, China, manufacturing hub of the world, that includes pharmaceuticals, that includes fentanyl and this kind of stuff. And yet in America, I think a lot of people who are disenfranchised with the big pharma system are looking to like ancient Chinese medicine for more wisdom about the body and better like processes and more holistic approaches. And there's like a old mystical Chinese philosophy about the body and healing that a lot of alternative thinking Americans are gravitating towards. And I just think it's funny that that's the source for the problem and solution in a sense because of the manufacturing. But going back to the Ivy League, people may not realize that, as you've pointed out, Harvard's endowment is $40 billion. They're sitting on $40 billion. It's invested. It's probably making more money even still, but they don't share that with America. They don't, you know, contribute anything or donate that to any systems that help regular people. And calling the Ivy League and Harvard like a venture capital firm is so good. It's almost like the show Shark Tank, where people come up with their pitches of what they might want to be. And Harvard decides, oh yeah, we'll take a shot on this guy. And like you say, it's just, you only need a couple of people to succeed. But when they rise the ranks in fame and fortune in America, it creates a perception to regular people that I can never get there without going to these schools.
That's
right. And yeah, it becomes like a marketing thing of successful people go to these five schools and that's it. So man, I know we are coming to the end of this thing. I really just got maybe two big questions for you. So when it comes to troubled times, a lot of people say that is when the mystics, the gurus, the more esoterically inclined people need to step up. The forecasters, you could say, they have to step up. There's a certain courage in forecasting in chaotic, scary times. Of course, power doesn't like it. You know, if we are using like a Harry Sheldon analogy from Foundation, that is it. You know, he comes up and says, hey, empire is going to collapse. And empire says, fuck you. You're going to collapse. I'm taking you out to the edge of the galaxy and you're going to die out. And then the whole series is about how, no, that little seed blossoms into something big. And the prediction comes to pass even when it's been spoken out to the world. That even can't stop it. So
that's right.
I am curious about the predictions you have given. Some of them are, I'd say, a little mild, even though obviously it's been a huge boon to the attention given to you. But do you have predictions that have come to you where you say, I can't bring that up. I can't go public with that. That's too extreme, or that's going to drive people crazy. Is there anything that you just haven't felt bold enough to come out with that you've gotten from the same mechanism?
Yeah, I believe that 99% of humanity will be wiped out in the next, you know, 100 years. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, a big like, one. Like, through what mechanism?
Well, I mean, you have a perfect storm of crises, okay, including a geophysical event, which might be a mini ice age, but it could also be like a polar shift, right? So you've seen the news about this polar shifting, right? Well, that has tremendous impact on the geophysical structure of the planet. And so you're going to have, you know, massive devastation, floods, earthquakes, tsunamis, all that. You also have a mini ice age that I think is going to appear. You're going to see a lot of extreme weather events in the winter. I think this winter is supposed to be extremely cold and destructive in the United States and in North America. You'll have epidemics raging. You'll have wars raging. You'll have revolutions. So, you know, for the next 20 years, it's like we're in a Kali Yuga and there's no escape from it. It's just gonna be worse and worse and worse. I mean, like, it doesn't benefit me or anyone for me to say this, right? It's like, okay, guys, for the next, you know, 50 years, it's just complete hopelessness until about 99% of humanity gets wiped out. And then maybe after that, we can start rebuilding. So I've never really said this before. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I asked. So, but this is also a thing. A lot of people who have the conscious connection or they get prophetic dreams, a lot of it is tragedy. And so you'll have people in like the 80s and 90s who have had these recurring dreams of nuclear exchanges and bombs going off and chaos and cataclysm. And yet here we are, you know, here we are 40 years later, half a human lifespan. What good is it to someone in the 80s to have these prophetic dreams of apocalyptic tragedy and then have it not manifest? So I'm not saying you're wrong, because I definitely believe in cyclical cataclysms, and there's a lot of research being done on resets and who built these buildings really. Like, did they just move in? And, you know, the Hopi talk about being taken underground by beings to survive such a cataclysm. So, like, it's in there. I agree. But sometimes the timeline, the timing of it is so off that it becomes useless information in a human lifespan. Because if you're talking potentially about something 500 years in the future, it means nothing to us today. Like, of course, it's eventually going to all collapse. There's something interesting about the people who have the consciousness connection oftentimes are being shown tragedy, regardless of if tragedy is near or not. It's just an interesting pattern I recognize. What do you think?
Yeah, so I think you're absolutely right in that every age will have its prophets, will have its mystics who see the future, but they don't really know the timeline, because remember, in the higher consciousness, there's no time and space, right? So something that could happen a year later, 100 years later, they don't know. They just know it's going to happen. So they have no sense of the timeline. And all they're doing is just telling people what they've seen. In my situation, what I've done is I've given a series of short-term predictions, including the destruction of Al-Aqsa Mosque, including the U.S. invasion of Iran, including NATO fighting Russia in Odessa. And these short-term predictions are a really good way for me to see if I actually have prophetic powers, if my prediction models actually do work. And if they work out, then you should, you know, maybe listen to me some more. But if they don't work out, then you know I'm a false prophet. And, you know, I can just go home and you guys can go listen to like Kurt Metzger or, you know, like whatever.
Alex Jones,
right? So yeah. So I think what's great about the internet is that it's a marketplace of ideas. And what's drawn people to me is the fact that I was able to predict certain events. And I continue to make big predictions. And if these predictions work out well, then I think that people should try to understand my worldview. The other thing is that, you know, I've always been a really shy person. I really don't like the limelight. Like, some people thrive in the limelight, right? Like some, like politicians, like Bill Clinton. I've actually seen Bill Clinton in person. I've actually attended a speech of his, and he'll give like a 20-minute speech, and he'll be different than a 3-hour shaking hands with people. He's a very social person. He just loves that. Whereas I hate that. I hate being in the public. I hate, you know, talking to people. It annoys me. It frustrates me.
So, I'm more like you.
Right. So I've chosen to speak out because something inside me said, now's time to speak up. You can't hide it anymore. You have to reveal yourself, and you have to like tell people what you know. And I understand there are lots of risks inherent in this. I mean, I could be shut down in terms of social media because of things I've said. I could be hunted down by nefarious forces for offering a counter narrative. I have 3 young kids, so I'm very protective of my 3 young kids. But you know, something is telling me, you have to speak up now because the time has come. And I don't know if I'm being delusional, but some force is telling me you have to speak up now, and you have to reveal yourself, and you have to be honest with people. Don't hide anymore. Be honest with people, and people will understand. And you know, if they don't understand, they will understand because of what will come.
Wow. I mean, this has just become so much more interesting than I even thought it would be, because you've opened up about some of that stuff. And that is a pattern with some guests I interview. Like, this is a common thing. I don't necessarily have it myself, but it's happening more and more to people I talk to. And it seems like fate brought us together. So this is the thing I think we should end on. So the predictions are a bit dire, sir, But you do have this post about what can be done. And you write, as the world splinters, we must hold ourselves together by embracing the ultimate truth. Love is the unifying force of the universe, and our imagination is the animating force. I predict that the world will go to hell, and many of you ask what can be done. First, appreciate that as we are in the universe, so is the universe in us. The ancients like to say, as above, so below. Through the intentions of our actions, we can alter the destiny of the universe. Second, appreciate that each and every one of us is here for a purpose, and we know it because we find delight in moving towards it, distress when we move away from it. The Greeks have a word for when we achieve our teleos, purpose, eudaimonia, flourishing. We flourish when we love, learn, and create. Third, start here and now. Commit to your own flourishing at this moment, and this moment becomes eternally yours. Well, I'll drink to that. But talk to us a little bit as we're wrapping up here about how we can actually implement those insights into meaningful action.
Well, so the powers that be, their main mechanism of control is your fear and your ego, right? The entire culture, especially in our culture, is structured around augmenting your fear and ego. And you have to learn to overcome your fear and your ego if you are to thrive as a human. And we're all meant to thrive. That's why God created us, to flourish. But to do that, you have to believe in your potential to love. And often, you know, the hardest thing is not to love someone, but to forgive yourself. Some of us have done so much transgressions, have committed so much evil, that we embrace the demonic forces. We've been traumatized as children. And so we feel as though the only salvation are these demonic forces. And what we need to believe is that this spark in us, it will never go away, because the spark is the vine. And the spark connects us to the vine, but it also means the vine in us. So if we continue to do evil, if we continue to transgress, then the vine becomes more corrupt. And that's actually the goal of the powers that be, to corrupt us so as to corrupt the vine. And so it's within your power to save God and to save yourself. But you just have to learn to forgive yourself and believe that you can be your own salvation and redemption. And that's the hardest thing to do, actually. Loving someone is not hard, but forgiving yourself is the hardest thing in the world. And that's why Jesus was so important. Jesus was such an important revelation, because now you have this external force that could forgive us. But Jesus will only take you part of the way. To go the full way, you have to embrace your own individuality. You have to believe in the divinity within you. And that's the hardest thing to do in the world. But once you do that, then you change the world for the better.
I love it. Awesome. Well, Professor, this has been a real treat. You've tapped into something that is really resonating with people, me included, and I congratulate you on the success. What's next? What should we tell people about following you going forward if they had a good time here?
Yeah, so I have two ways that I communicate with the world. My first is my YouTube channel, Predictive History. So I upload all my lectures to that channel. There are lots of channels that counterfeit me, that take my material and turn it into clips. I'm not associated with them. I'm okay with sharing my message. And I actually thank them for making my lectures much more digestible. But please remember that I only have one official channel, and it's Predictive History. Okay, so you can watch that, all my lectures on YouTube. I also have a Substack that you can subscribe to, in which I write essays. And it's a pretty diverse group of essays, but sometimes I write about geopolitics as well, and I'm focusing a lot on geopolitics because I'm afraid that we're headed towards war in the Middle East. I think it's very likely that America will attack Iran in the next few weeks, possibly next week sooner. So those are the best two ways to get in touch with me. I also have a Twitter account. You can follow me on Twitter at Xue Qinjiang. But my Substack and my YouTube channel are the best ways to follow my work.
Awesome. And if people have a hard time spelling the Twitter handle, I'll put it in the show notes so you could just click and follow. Man, amazing stuff. Just I'm all charged up for the day, but thank you so much and take care.
Right. Great. Thanks so much, Greg. It was lovely to talk, and let's try to do this again sometime.
Yes, indeed. Well, hallelujah. Take me home, country roads. Now that was something. I know Professor Jiang is getting a ton of attention, and I'm really thankful that a pretty odd little synchronicity brought us together. I told you guys that I've kind of felt like I'm in flow for the first time in many years. I even cited that Kurt Metzger interview where he had me on his show in the list of reasons to do the Charlie Kirk solo examination. I don't even want to say solo show. It was only 45 minutes, but it was a deep dive into the available material at the time. And it became the biggest flood of new subscriptions that I can remember, at least since COVID, probably further back than that. And one of the recent THC clips that the clip makers used was from the Plasma show, but it was a clip about manifestation. And I saw comments on there that manifestation is bullshit. The kids in Gaza can't seem to manifest their way out of the situation. Manifestation is a lame, new agey, first world, rich person's kind of mindset. Easy to manifest when you have everything. You know, these sorts of comments that you hear on the subject. And I do get that mindset. I have definitely been in the mental state of fuck all that. Everyone's out to get me. I can't seem to get ahead. And if any magic really worked, then it would work for me. But yet, how often do we actually hone in on an intention and direct that intention and then actually follow through and act on messages in our intuition? Oftentimes, we ask for something and then it comes to us in the form of an intuition or a lead we should follow. And we don't take the advice. Well, what else can you do? But these things are probability enhancers is another factor. So if you're living in a war zone, that's probably going to be a war zone for a long time. Well, in that case, it's not about one person's will and meditation practice resulting in the end of the war, although maybe that can happen. But it would be more like being in tune with the deeper parts of yourself, and then something in your awareness tells you to cross the street, and then you listen to that voice, and then the building you just walked away from is hit by a rocket. To me, that's a better example of how it could work in that scenario, but I'm only bringing this up because in mine, I did this research on Charlie Kirk, and then I planned to talk about it as a guest with Kurt Metzger, and it didn't really go that way. So then it's this unused material up in my head. And then I ask the universe on my way to the studio for guidance, just as an experiment. And I get there and the guest who'd already confirmed doesn't show up. Like, it's very weird that they wouldn't show up because they already said, see you tomorrow, talk to you tomorrow. Like, I've since spoken with them and it's fine, but something in the universe moved that out of the way. And then an inner voice said, hey, sit down, record this thing, clear out all this information from your head and grab all the links and the screenshots you've had and put it out there. And 9 out of 10 times, I would say, no, I'm just going to take the day off and we'll try again on the next one. I love to do that. And the subs flooded in because I basically listened and took it a step further. And then that brings us up to date. Professor Zhang, a guest who I'm really interested in having on, from Beijing, who's going super viral, which, again, I usually wouldn't even ask. I'm like, oh, you either just did Rogan or you're getting too much attention. I'll wait till it dies down and then I'll ask, because that's just how I kind of operate. But this particular guy happens to be a fan of Kurt Metzger, of all people, and is listening when I'm the guest. And then a super chat references him in the show. And that nudges me to ask for an interview the next day, to which he agrees, and then here we are. I only say this as an example of how it works. I don't really like to talk about myself too much, but I guess for a long time, I've been talking to guests for 15 years, and they have all these wild stories about listening to their intuition, and I'm like, oh, I don't get messages. Well, I think I maybe learned a little bit better recently how to hear that message, and I'm all jazzed up about it. I hope that happens for everyone. But it's like, oh, that was it? I guess I have noticed that in there, but I never bring it to the forefront and give it my attention. And now that I have, like, wow. Action, result. How funny. It's like this time I just channeled Jim Carrey and Yes Man, and had this string of fulfilling events happen, and it's basically the grand finale to that loop to have this interview. As far as I know, the loop could continue. But then if someone were to ask me how it works, I would just repeat what all the guests have said. Have clear intentions, ask for guidance, and then act on the intuition. Listen really closely. Listen deeply. It is subtle, and I have missed it a lot, but I didn't this time. And the Charlie Kirk thing has gotten even crazier, that it almost deserves a part two. But I don't want people to think I can't be more creative than that and return to that well again. It looks very desperate. But the more people dig into this and share the results, and the more I see on it, the weirder it does get. The more I lean towards theater. But something stops me from committing to that idea overall. As I said, I don't think they have a problem killing a guy. But when you see crisis actors across multiple events emerging in this event, and you see how far back some of the relationships go, you do have to wonder, maybe there is a mafia-like concept of a made man, even among enemies. Look at the past, and so often they don't really kill a leader who lost in war. They send him to live in exile, because you don't lose your life even when you're beat, if you're part of that elite. There is some truth there, but sadly, I don't think I'll ever fully understand it, and I don't know if Charlie Kirk was a disposable pawn to them or an actor playing a crucial role. Seems like a big loose end to have him out in the world, unless, of course, there's a place out in the world where there's a guarantee that they won't be found, that all these sorts of people go to. A Valhalla, of a certain sense. Anyway, back to this interview, and not to launch right into a plus pitch, but if you heard the full two-hour show, then this is even more fascinating when Professor Jiang talked about the mystical methods from which he gets his predictive protocols, or at least some of them. One of the streams of insight he gets that helps him come up with these pretty accurate predictions, at least so far. I did not expect his story to have that dimension to it, because he does seem very logic-based in his assessments, and even he said that, but I just was so happy to hear him share that stuff. And now we can confirm that he is, in fact, a modern mystic and a proper forecaster, a proper vessel for prophecy. I also didn't expect to hear him bringing up elite communication with dark beings or utter the term lizard people, but that's the way it went. It was great that he was aware of our format, and I think he strategically opened up to some of that stuff in the second hour, so I don't want to put him on blast too much for some of those things he said. His words should speak for themselves. But plus, people know I'm not just blowing smoke, or they would lose their trust in me, and so I'm saying that genuinely. There are checks and balances here, true checks and balances. And I was really impressed with his comments on China, too. I definitely can be kind of weird sometimes, because I'm very skeptical of power and power networks and relationships and following the money and all that stuff. But I can also be very naive and trusting when it comes to individuals. I know there's people in the audience who think, yeah, when you trusted that guy, or you didn't challenge that guy, I know exactly what you mean. It is a strange combination for a person, but I do try to think things through. And before this one, I kind of thought, well, Professor Jiang's material is super interesting. And we have a lot of it being him teaching the conspiratorial undercurrent in the West to Westerners, you know, through the vehicle of these recorded lectures. I mean, he's literally talking to Chinese high school students, but the popularity he's found online is mostly with Westerners learning about their own system. That's great. It's also probably not material that the CCP would object to at all. So I planned to ask him more about China, and I wasn't sure how it would go. I thought those answers might be a little more tame, but they weren't. They were very insightful, and it is a different culture, yet so many strategies of their own elite work in the same way. So there were some unique insights there for me, for sure. I hope he didn't put himself at risk to pass along those insights. You just never know how to separate the propaganda from the reality, knowing that totalitarianism is in season, in vogue, and you know, you don't trust any elite necessarily, but you know your own system is demonizing every other one out there and pretending that it's 10 times worse when maybe it's only twice as bad. We know the old phrase, find out who you're not allowed to criticize and you'll see who's really in charge. I think depending on where you are, there's different answers to that. But he did mention some topics that he hoped we would get into when we were off the air and that we didn't. And it seems like we're both pretty excited about getting together again. And I'm sure the people will respond well and we'll cover those topics then. You got to get to know someone before you bring up some of this stuff. You know, you really got to ease your way in. So now that we're well acquainted, I think we can just rip the Band-Aid off and go right for the wound. Definitely shoot him a message or give him a comment or something to say you enjoyed this interview. We want to keep it top of mind. I want people to know that he was heard. I want him to know. I want guests to know that they were heard and enjoyed here. So that's important. But these do seem like frightening times in a lot of ways. I mean, my life is kind of going great right now. Same with most of the people in my circles. I do know a few people crashing out. I know a few people with Trump derangement syndrome letting him take up every square inch of their mental and emotional space. But those are outliers. When I look, though, at the next 5 to 10 years out, the geopolitical arc, the economic arc, that is what makes me nervous. I'm doing good now, but my kids won't even be in high school when we get through some of this stuff. I'm really worried about what their coming of age years will look like. But I have to acquiesce and say, hey, this is their life to live. They chose this time, as I chose this time. They chose to have me and their mom as their guides, and they will do what they're going to do. All we can do is create sanctuary for them and do our best to keep the world out there at bay and guard the sanctity of our inner circle. We'll see how it goes. I saw a great meme of a guy in a gas mask in a Mad Max-like scenario, and he says, hey, buddy, I know it's really hard out there. I know it's really tough right now, okay? But in the second panel, he says, but it's going to get a lot worse. And that's just so funny to me. That is the general sentiment right now. So you do have to preserve your energy and you don't want to waste it on the run up to big things. You know, this is a sacred time. If you think big things are coming, don't waste the good time beforehand just worrying about them. What will be, will be. So the predictions in this one did get a bit dire towards the end, as predictions often are. We have so many people with apocalyptic dreams and visions of nuclear holocaust and all this sort of stuff. And it's a damn near consistent thing that if you're looking for people who are getting those messages, they're usually doom and gloom. I think you could even say that Chris Bledsoe, they're looking at a time when the lady said that's about Easter of this upcoming year. Sure, usually it is about some profound tragedy, but if this stuff comes from a realm without time, then maybe there's not a lot of value in assuming it's going to happen now or in our lifetime. That seems to be the consistent thing. Prophet says, I get these messages. They come with insights that make those messages more interesting or seem more accurate or potent or worth listening to. And then there's this big culminating event at the end of their predictive narrative. And then that thing doesn't happen. And then everyone forgets about that person. I'm not saying Professor Jiang falls exactly into that archetype, but I will say that that archetype is out there and it's something to think about and, you know, for him to try to avoid and for people to consider when assessing a situation or just information that comes from that way. It's really not about the person. They're a conduit, but information that comes from that sort of source tends to have that stuff built into it. I don't know. All right. Well, What are you going to do about a war? I don't know. I don't know anyone who cares about fighting anyone. I think everybody wants to just live their own life, but yet it's interesting that we have no control. The train seems to be running right off the tracks, well outside of our ability to influence it much, just on the momentum. So again, just be the best port in the storm for other people and hone in on the handful of things that you can control that dictate your highest order of happiness and fulfillment, and put the extra mental energy you have into that. Less screen time, more me time, right? Put that on a shirt. So powerhouse guest, fun synchronicity that put me in the current of the insanely powerful flow right now that is Professor Zhang, and help more people hear about it. That's really all I can ask. And higher side news, I mentioned an email notification system for the TV tier people, and that is probably about another week away, some more testing to do before we really launch it, but it is close. Other than that, try not to spend unnecessary money and resist the temptation to constantly meddle in the system instead of just being happy and satisfied with what we have. So I really don't hear very many complaints. The engine is running well, and I should just let that be okay. In the last episode with Richard Willett, another one that I knew would keep the great reviews coming strong and the rating trend high as it has been. And I was right, 4.8, pretty much the A+ around here. There's always someone who wishes we were talking about pyramids or aliens or some unrelated topic to whatever it was. But still, if you can please 90 to 95% of the people who rate a show with this diverse of a topic spread, it's a win. I would also be surprised if we weren't right up there with a 4.8 again today, but the people will let me know, I'm sure. All right. Kind of going to keep this moving because I have a big interview tomorrow and I want to make sure I'm fully ready to crush it, and the day is already getting away from me. But as for the meetup calendar, let's take a look at what we got. Okay, we're looking at October 8th in Dayton, Ohio, Riverscape Metro Park, the Cole Bitter Collective, and then October 9th, the very next day, New Haven, Connecticut at Three Sheets, and then October 17th, Elkin, North Carolina at the Rail Yard, and October 27th, we got one at Volksbar in Berlin, Germany. Okay. Getting together in Berlin. I do hear about some rough stuff going on in the news there. It seems very easy to get a knock on the door over your social media posts these days in Germany. Probably a good time to find the others, I would say. And then November 5th, there is one happening in Oakland, although it looks like they didn't fill out all the details. But remember the 5th of November, and remember to go in and fill that stuff out so people know exactly where the meetup will happen. November 8th, Woodstock, Virginia at the Woodstock Brewhouse, and November 10th, Galbraith's Ale House again in Eden Terrace, Auckland, New Zealand. Really great. HiresideMeetups.com. Anyone can make an event and get a local gathering together. You know, over 100,000 people listening. What, 10 people who want to actually use the calendar? It's fine. But if you heard about an event near you and you want to go, please RSVP so the host knows what to expect. I've gotten lots of great reports over the years since we've been doing this that usually you can depend on a handful to a dozen people showing up in most major cities, and then you keep everyone's info and then they become either your new regular hangs or at least a strong network of good people to know in troubled times. So check it out. All right. Just so happy to get this episode out there. I felt a real kindred spirit ship with Professor Yang, and I love the guy. He's awesome. I look forward to doing it again if we get the chance. But that is it for me. I'm sure very few people need me to remind them to check out Predictive History. I'm sure you already have in one form or another, but we got YouTube, Substack, and you can find them also on Twitter. And it seems like he's gone about as viral as anyone can. So this is one where I'm on the lucky end of being able to put this out. But It is what it is. I'm riding the wave. Sign up for Plus if you like what I do. Ad-free and action-packed 5 full 2-hour interviews every month. And an archive that goes back 15 years for as low as $8. Sign up with the links in the show notes and cancel anytime, though I do hope to keep it at a high level so you don't. Anyway, I'm out of here. I've done my part. Your move, global chess game players, geopolitical conflict engineers, and agents of the Archons. Your fucking move.
Do you feel betrayed by the ones you're told to trust? Well, you know you don't get much help from the ones that beat you up like a dog that don't obey. We're just left to lick the wounds. They say that it will be okay, or at least be over soon. And the cycle continues, 'cause we don't seem to care for the ones who come after. Circuses really is an awful trade, but what are you gonna do? It's the deal our parents made. We see the crash is coming, why won't someone grab the wheel? Apathetic to the next collision, haven't even had the time to heal. So the cycle continues, 'cause we don't make the space for the ones who come after. Much love lost in this place. They don't change their ways at the top, so we gotta change ours. Make all the new pain stop and tell the story of our scars. But it all seems so hard to do, and who else will try? Just wanna be comfortable, I guess. Easier to believe the lies. So the cycle continues, 'cause it's all about me. And the ones that come after can try to get themselves free. We always have the numbers, we never have the drive. We sometimes have the mindset right, rarely tempted to thrive. Too much weight. Truly go for the win, so again we pun. And the cycle continues, we don't even discuss for the ones who come after, 'cause no one did it for us. The cycle continues, ignorance and blind faith. Hope the ones who come after can learn from our mistakes.